1/3, just for 2 weeks.
Good morning, Your Honor. 10/2 for Mr. Maher, Jerome Maher, in Denver Bay. Denver Bay is in first row, that very good-looking woman who happens to be my spouse. In any event, Your Honor, in preparing this argument, one of the lawyers that gave me a good piece of advice, probably our most prominent lawyer in the state of Illinois, you'll probably recognize the same, but in case you don't, he was from downstate Illinois, not too far from where I was born.
Isn't this case about race judicata rather than individual personalities?
Well, Judge, my answer is contrary to what Mr. Lincoln said, and that is, my answer is yes and no. Certainly, race judicata is an issue. However...
But weren't all the arguments you're raising raised and decided or could have been by the Seventh Circuit?
No. I say that categorically no, because in the year 2002, the then receiver conveyed all its assets and conveyed liabilities to the FDIC, terminating effective January 1st, 2002, its receivership. Now, there is no way in the prior litigation...
This was the Verizon Group.
That's correct, Your Honor. Actually, when you say Verizon Group, Verizon was taken over around January 11th, 1990, and immediately thereafter, they conveyed all their interests. That is, the appointed receiver conveyed all its interests to the concept, they created a new bank and conveyed all liabilities and assets to the new bank.
And your contention is that the FDIC, its receiver, improperly failed to make payouts to your clients when they should have done that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, however...
And the problem is that same claim seems to have been litigated in district court and brought up to the Seventh Circuit and rejected. And that's the basis for the race judicata. So why isn't it race judicata?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure which occasion you're talking about.
I'm talking about the second Seventh Circuit decision.
Oh, the second Seventh, because the first Seventh Circuit decision said we don't mean to say...
I understand. I'm just talking about the second.
The second one said, in accordance with, I think, what was Your Honor's position, slavery, you can't collect. There's no money left. It's moot. Slattery is exactly to the contrary, and we submitted that there was a case...
What do you mean? Does that mean the Seventh Circuit was wrong?
Yes, Judge.
Well, nothing we can do about that.
No, except, Your Honor, you can file slattery.
Well, what... I don't understand how following slattery helps. In slattery, we recognize that these claims might be brought against the United States as well as against the FDIC. But under the restatement, where the United States' liability depends on the FDIC's liability, it's the same claim as was brought originally in the Seventh Circuit, even though the nominal defendant, the United States, in the Tucker Act case, is different from the FDIC. It's still the same claim.
But the restatement, Your Honor, also says that race judicata does not apply if there has not been a full, fair hearing. That's in accordance with the United States Supreme Court standard.
What was unfair about the hearing in the Seventh Circuit?
It was not on the merits. We had no opportunity to to sit back and prove our claim in spite of the fact that ERISA and FIREA both say you've got to give notice when you're denying a claim. Now, the argument has been made, well, you know, sure you filed a claim, but you didn't pursue it. But ERISA says this. I'm sorry, FIREA says this. If your litigation has been pending before a receiver for the institution was appointed, then you could continue your litigation. That's exactly what we did, and that's written into the law, and also it's clear from the congressional reports that was their intent.
If the Seventh Circuit had said, we, given the same reason, said we reject the claim on the merits, would you agree that it's res judicata?
If the Seventh Circuit had said that you were excused from exhausting your remedies because you followed the law passed by Congress, namely the FIREA, that says if the litigation was in progress before the receiver was appointed, and the receiver here was appointed.
But what I'm trying to get at is this a question of terminology? Because the Seventh Circuit referred to this as justiciability rather than using the term merits, that somehow that makes a difference, it's because they use the wrong terminology, it's not res judicata. Is that what the theory is?
I don't think so, Judge. I think it's not a question of terms, it's a question of what's this, substance of their ruling. And the substance of their ruling, number one, was yes, we do have jurisdiction under ERISA. Whether or not they might have jurisdiction under anything else. That's number one. Number two is having jurisdiction under ERISA. Suddenly they fall into the position that not only was there a fiduciary relationship that FIREA commands in Section 18 of Title 12, it commands it, but also if you are taking over a pension, as the assumption agreement clearly said in January of 1990, that the conservator, who was appointed then, is obligated to pay all pension funds. That's in the, we set it forth in the very words. So, when that case went up to the U.S. Court of Appeals, the first time in the Seventh Circuit said, of course, we are not saying that any contract rights which invested are disturbed or prevented by this ruling. They just held it clearly that that was not the case. That the vested rights were out the window. That, of course, is consistent with ERISA. And if they wanted to sit back and deny the right, they must give notice. We were never given notice of the termination of the receivership. However, in the Seventh Circuit, the very case Your Honor was inquiring about, the attorney for the FDIC said, oh, well, we did publish in the Federal Register that we were going to terminate the receivership. Now, the Supreme Court, in several cases, one is Tulsa, a case which we've cited, another is the Mennonite case, which we have cited, and there are several others that we haven't bothered to cite, which say this, when property rights, or the life of a person, of course, is at stake, you must, in Justice O'Connor's words, you must give notice that is calculated to inform. Now, I don't know if anybody here in this room today consistently reads the Federal Register. I certainly don't think the average layperson does. I think the average lawyer doesn't either. However, in Tulsa, what happened in Tulsa was there was a publication made in the local newspaper saying everybody might have a claim against the decedent's estate. File it. You have, actually, it was short there. You only had 60 days in the state of Oklahoma. And Supreme Court said, this creditor derives its rights from being the assignee of the doctors. It was a collection agent. The doctors would perform the last medical services. You've got to give notice reasonably calculated to inform, in Justice O'Connor's words. Was the notice adequate? Publishing it in the Federal Register, saying you can comment. Didn't even say, say come in. You can comment.
Is this the first time, Mr. Dewey, you've raised that point in court?
No, Your Honor. On the oral argument in the Seventh Circuit, in the case Judge Dyke is referring to, that for the first time, the FDIC attorney in oral argument informed us that it was published in the Federal Register. Absolutely no knowledge before him.
But you were complaining about the lack of notice in the Seventh Circuit proceeding, right?
Yes, we were, Judge.
So that's the problem.
Well, Your Honor,
whether they were right or wrong or whatever, they made a decision, and you can't get a second bite at the apple. That's the problem.
Well, Judge, they made a decision. Notice or not notice, there's no money. It's moot. Now, it seems to me this court has the obligation to decide, do we follow the Seventh Circuit? Do we follow Slattery? And on the following Slattery side, do we follow the obligations that Congress has put on the receiver under FIREA, put on the receiver who's now acting as the administrator of any pension rights.
Still, you wanted to save some time for rebuttal. You will want to give a rebuttal time. You can either continue or save it.
I'll save it, Your Honor.
Mr. Phillips, President.
May it please the Court, I'd like to discuss two points this morning. One is the doctrine of res judicata, and the second point would be the statute of limitations. Going back to the first point, res judicata, this case is about whether or not Messrs. Maher and Gravey are entitled to relitigate an issue that they have previously litigated and lost, and most recently the Seventh Circuit, and two other litigations before that. The answer to that question must be no, as the doctrine of res judicata bars the relitigation of issues that have already been decided. This current action is the fourth time that Messrs. Maher and Gravey have attempted to collect on their employment contracts with Horizon Savings Bank.
Yeah, but the key question is whether the second Seventh Circuit decision is res judicata. It's difficult to view the first one. I think res judicata here is difficult to view the Maher decision, which rejected the Winstar theory as being res judicata.
Yes, Your Honor, but the Seventh Circuit decision is res judicata on this issue. What the Seventh Circuit addressed was whether or not Messrs. Maher and Gravey could bring their claim for employment benefits against Horizon Bank yet again. Their claim was against the bank, and once the bank was placed in receivership, therefore against FDIC as receiver. But FDIC as receiver merely steps into the shoes of the insolvent institution. The Court of the Seventh Circuit addressed that issue and determined that any claim would be moot as the FDIC receiver had completely resolved Horizon Savings Bank through the insolvency. So there was nothing left to pay any judgment from. Additionally, the Seventh Circuit looked at this issue and said that any other claim that Mr. Maher or Gravey could have raised was either raised and decided before or could have been raised. Most importantly, Mr. Maher and Ravi in this current action assert the same claim for these employment benefits. This time it's under a legal theory of breach of a fiduciary duty. The issue hasn't changed, it's just a new legal theory, which is a current theme in all of the litigations Mr. Maher and Ravi have had in this case. This theory of breach of fiduciary duty skips the first step, which the Court of Federal Claims addressed, that Mr. Maher and Ravi never actually established themselves as creditors of Horizon Savings Bank. That issue was first decided in the Harris Trust litigation.
I don't understand. I mean, your argument is brought the same claim in the Seventh Circuit proceeding that they will want to investigate. Why are you trying to argue the underlying merits? It's not before us what they're creditors or non creditors. You know, that would have to be decided if the Court of Federal Claims addressed the merits.
That is true, Your Honor. I was merely raising that to explain the basis for it. Department of Justice agreed that this issue is barred as res judicata because it had already been determined by the Seventh Circuit that the claim couldn't go forward as moot, and regardless, all of that issue had either been decided previously or could have been raised previously.
Mr. Phillips, this case strikes me as a classic example of no good deed goes unpunished. If I read the record correctly, Mr. Ravi had valuable pension rights with the original savings and loan. Had they stayed with that original savings and loan, they probably would be happily retired on their pensions long ago. But they responded to a government request that their savings and loan bail out, the government, by merging with several troubled savings. That's correct so far. Subsequently, as part of that merger, they agreed to transfer their pension rights to the new merged group, Horizon organization. That was almost 30 years ago. And they've been trying to get their pension rights ever since. And every time they turn, the government blocks on one theory or another. Do I misunderstand the fundamental case, which is they had pension rights, they did the government a favor by merging to save a couple of, three, I think, that were failing personnels, and now the government for 30 years has said, no, you can't have your pension rights? That's puzzling. What am I missing?
I think there's one point in there, Your Honor, that we think is incorrect. In 1982, when these supervisory mergers occurred, and the bank and the FDIC discussed this, FDIC stated that because these pensions were on the books, the supervisory mergers couldn't go forward. The only way the mergers would go forward is if these pensions were somehow adjusted. Horizon Savings Bank chose to adjust the pensions. A few years
later, they were willing to help the government out and to let you transfer their pension rights to a new organization in order to make the merger possible. Is that what you're saying?
That's one way to look at it, Your Honor. I think the more important way to look at it, we're missing the fact that Horizon Savings Bank gained valuable consideration in these deals. By entering into these supervisory mergers, Horizon Savings Bank was able to.
Okay, but Horizon then goes under because Congress takes away supervisory goodwill, which you may remember in Windstar, we found to be constitutionally unacceptable. And so don't tell me about how Horizon benefited, because they went belly up because of what the government later did. So Horizon didn't benefit. These fellows ended up with no pensions. What's going on? Please explain to me, what is it that the government thinks should be done with this case?
The government believes this case should be dismissed on res judicata grounds, Your Honor. At bottom, this is not a Windstar-related case. While those issues may have arisen with Horizon Savings Bank, the issue before this court and the issue that Mr. Maher and Ravi have raised is whether or not they're entitled to collect on contracts they have with Horizon Savings Bank, which was deemed insolvent and entered receivership.
I understand the technicality of the government's position, which you've now been arguing for five litigations. And every time they try another move, you all counter them and have been very successful at it, either because they make the wrong moves or for whatever reason. At some point, do they ever get their pensions?
They do not get their pension, John, because they failed to follow the procedure and establish themselves as creditors of Horizon Savings Bank in the beginning, which was the size of the Seventh Circuit.
They never get their pensions because they lost. It's res judicata. You know, it's not. Stop discussing the merits. The merits are not before us, right?
The merits are not before you, Your Honor.
You can't decide this case based on the merits.
No, this court cannot, Your Honor. This court has to decide this issue based on whether or not res judicata applies. The government's position is, because these issues were either decided or could have been raised in the previous litigations, that res judicata bars Mr. Maher and Gravi from advancing their claim in this case. Regarding our second point, Your Honor, the statute of limitations, should the court find that res judicata does not apply in this case, statute of limitations should also bar Mr. Maher and Gravi's claim for the Court of Federal Claims. They brought their claim in 2008. In their complaint, they stated that the actions for which they were seeking redress occurred 15 years prior, at the very latest in 1993. The 28 U.S.C. 2501 establishes a 6-year limitations period to bring a claim in the Court of Federal Claims. Because Mr. Maher and Gravi weren't timely in asserting this claim, the court can affirm the Court of Federal Claims dismissal on that alternate ground. And for these reasons, Your Honor, we ask that the court affirm the Court of Federal Claims dismissal, barring Mr. Maher and Gravi's claim on the basis of res judicata.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the assertion was just made we didn't timely file our claims. We got to this in spring of 1990 to file your claims. What did we do with the time allotted? We filed a claim. That was a notice, in effect, from the consulate. Then, after our litigation was filed in the state court, they said it was filed in the federal court, it was filed in the state court and then removed to the federal court by the conservator, and we had also named Reconstruction Trust as the, not just the conservator, but as the receiver. They came in and said, no, we as a receiver, we disposed of all our assets to a new bank, we have no part in this. We got this messed up early on in the litigation. Litigation continues, and then a receiver is appointed in March of the following year. At that point, we've got a receiver appointed, and we've got litigation going, and the receiver gives us notice, filed a claim, we filed a claim again. Never has it been asserted you didn't file time. Never. As a matter of fact, contrary to the express provisions of ERISA, never ruled on the claim. Now, when they ruled,
why did you file on the Court of Federal Claims?
In the Court of Federal Claims, we actually didn't initially file there. A district court judge transferred a case that they brought against our people with counterclaims, and the counterclaim was transferred to the Court of Federal Claims. We didn't seek out the Court of Federal Claims in the sense of filing our claim there. It was transferred.
Well, this contract claim against the United States belongs to the Court of Federal Claims.
Your Honor, that's what Judge Burns in the initial case called the Harris case commented about. That's what.
At which point, though, you did not then file the Court of Federal Claims?
Judge. We had an ongoing case with the judge who had set a trial date. Actually, this was at the end of the trial that Judge Burns made that comment. It wasn't in the holding, but he made that comment. Then, of course, that case went up on appeal, and again, the Seventh Circuit says we don't need to state that you don't have a remedy for a violation of your vested contract rights. What are we to think of? So at that point, the case which transferred the counterclaim
to the Court of Federal Claims was pending. In any event, Your Honor,
under ERISA, you had to file within a certain time frame your claim, didn't you, administratively?
Judge, under ERISA, we think we filed timely by filing our claims with the receiver.
But that isn't what the statute provides.
Well, Your Honor, the statute provides that the big burden is on the FDIC and its predecessor because they owe fiduciary duties to us. And there's nothing in the record that shows how they observe those fiduciary duties, either under ERISA or under the pension statute. Now, I would also say that we pointed out to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the case Your Honor was talking about, we pointed out how the Ninth Circuit had said, wait a minute, receiver, FDIC, you've got to pay. You can't discriminate against the
First Empire.
Pardon me?
First Empire.
First Empire.
Yeah. So maybe the Seventh Circuit was wrong. Maybe they weren't. Maybe it would have come out differently in the Ninth Circuit. Trouble is they made a decision. That's your problem.
Well, Judge, I would grant you if we could have gone to the Ninth Circuit, it would have come out differently. And we didn't shock Slattery. Slattery was decided by this court, and this court is one, has been said just a few minutes ago, contract claims belong in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. That's where we are now.
The time has expired, so thank you very much for taking the case under advisement.
Thank you, Judge.